Okay, we're going to cover right now this sort of the general categories where, how you can look at risk. And again, I'm pulling from this USDA template on risk management and the five categories. The first one is production risk. And this is essentially those risks that are going to impact and affect how much you produce. And so on some levels, we're talking about how much fish you can actually bring to the dock. And so there's lots of risks along the way there. And some of them are related to things like equipment failure, again, no fish perhaps, or if it's just a bad year and low runs. And also safety factors into this and things like pollution as well. These are all risks that you may face in the production phase. There's other risks that are out there when you're fishing. Marine mammal interactions, okay? Colliding with another boat. So sinking, drowning, RSW failure, engine failure, mechanical failure, bad weather. Perhaps other fishermen working in your area to limit your production. Okay, spoiled fish or poor fish quality. These are all risks, and in some way, you want to be able to think about how you're going to address all of them in your operation. Next category, thank you, is market risk, which is essentially low prices. And this is one of those categories where you really may not have a lot of control over what happens in the market, but there's some things that you can do, certainly things that you can think about that may help limit the low prices that you receive. And sometimes, obviously, you can't do much about it. But let's take a look at these. One of the risks in the market is not having any buyers, right? Or having one buyer or two buyers. We all know that that in the fishing business, when you have a lot of buyers out there, when there's a lot of interest in the fish, that tends to push the price up. So sometimes you have certain regions like Chignik, for example, where there's only one buyer in the area. Even further out in the Alaska Peninsula, you have fewer and fewer buyers. So it tends to create a little bit of price disadvantage for the harvester. There are competing products oftentimes, and these can be products competing with you right at the dock. I mean, other fishermen that are bringing in the same kinds of fish that you are. How can you compete against that level of supply? And there are competing products in the market, and not just aquaculture, but other protein sources. And finally, consumer trends is another kind of marketing risk. Really, you don't have a lot of control over these, but you can be thinking about them in your operation in anticipation of what they might be like. And so you can try to again, mitigate or maybe take advantage of some changing trends that are in the market. So, it's things to think about. And we'll look at some of that. Next category, legal risk. And these, the legal risks are, I think they cover a lot of the other areas. It's not that I'll be talking about stuff here that isn't a risk in your productions and operations. For instance, the first one would be, damages that may occur while you're fishing. Obviously, that's a production issue. But we talk about legal risks when we start to talk about incidents that move into the judicial realm or to the realm of regulatory violations or lawsuits, fines and penalties and those kinds of things. And so we're calling these legal risks. And there's a lot of them out there. And the big one really is liability or damages that occur when you're at the helm. Or you're responsible for the ship, and that's a big area for people in fishing. Not getting paid, and what can you do about that? A good old-fashioned audit is another potential risk, and there's a few more things like not being accurately permitted, fishing out of your area or out of season. You do hear about a number of folks who were caught fishing illegally, and they face huge fines for that. Liens against your property. Okay. So anyways, those are types of legal risks. And we'll take a look at some of those in more detail. Okay. Next slide. Okay, financial risk is the fourth category. And these are things related to the financial inner workings of your business and things you need to protect against. Some of it's pretty obvious. The risk of fishing in a low-value fishery. What if the fishery you've been doing for the last 10, 15 years all of a sudden turns into a stinker? and you're not making enough money. It's good to know when that point is, so you don't go out and waste a lot of money pursuing a fishery that's not going to actually provide any revenues to you. Not having enough working capital is an example of a risk. Not being able to get a loan, and of course having money to pay taxes. Those are all examples of financial risks that you have in your business. There are others, things like when the day comes when you have more debts than you have assets, that's a big problem. Or you find yourself paying really high interest rates instead of something more moderate. You've got yourself in a high debt position that's eating away at your profits. Those are all examples of financial risk. The final category is human risks. We'll click to that. Thank you. And this is mainly talking about injury to crew, another example of a human risk might be having no labor. But with crew injuries, it's one of the biggest issues for a fisherman. And so there's a lot of things you can do to help prevent what could be a really horrible and costly situation. And certainly it's good for you. It's really good for your crew if you can provide them adequate protection in the case of injury. It's important that they have means to heal, and obviously that it doesn't cost you your boat and your fishing operation and your home and everything else too. So very important. Okay, next slide. Now, just in general, this is just generalizing here. There are ways that you can handle risks, and here's four that we have here for you. The four are avoidance, retention, mitigation, and transfer. Pretty obvious stuff when you start to think about it. First way you can deal with risk is you can just plumb avoid it. Now, we talked about staying in bed your whole life and never getting up, and then you avoid almost all the risks there are, except the bed sores. But really, that's not realistic. But there are certainly some times, if you're going to be in business, in the fishing industry, there are certainly some things you just plumb avoid. If the weather's horrible, maybe it gets above a certain threshold, you don't go out there. Maybe one area is renowned for just nasty currents and horrible weather when it's at a certain level, and you just know enough not to go in that area. You're just avoiding one huge risk, and that's useful, I think. So there's certainly some times when you avoid a fishery. Retention means that you take the risk on and you deal with it. And one of the examples we just covered lightly here was market risk. Fishermen are price takers. They've really not a lot they can do about that. They're going to take whatever price oftentimes that they're given. And so you're retaining a lot of that market risk. If you look at information comparing X vessel value and the wholesale price of fish, you'll see a pretty even margin. And when the values are down, that margin remains the same for the processor, but that price that the fisherman gets just continues to fall. So you are in an untenable position there as a fisherman in the price you take, and you're retaining a lot of that risk, obviously. Mitigation, I think, is the most common sense approach to a lot of risks, and that's simply putting steps in place to deal with the disaster when it happens. Okay, so you've taken a lot of steps either to prevent it from happening, or if it does happen, to make it as minimal a problem as possible. So, and we do mitigation work in a lot of different ways, obviously. And the last one is to transfer that risk to someone else. And this is just basically insuring your various parts of your business, or perhaps contracting out certain functions. So that's the transferring of risk. Okay, next. Oh, you got it. Great, thank you. So first one, we're going to go back to production risk. And what we'll do is we'll take a look at some examples of risks that are out there and just some of the things that you can do and include in, say, a business plan to discuss how you're going to deal with those risks. This is far from comprehensive, and as you can imagine, and you can see as we go through this, but I just think we're going to do a couple examples so we can get in the flow, and then you can obviously do this in your own business, and you don't have to have a big fancy business plan to do it, but it's a good process to walk through every once in a while to see where things are at. Okay, here's just one production risk that I could see happening a lot, something like equipment failure, be it your engine, your RSW, gear, your electrical system, okay, lots of things can go wrong. You're basically a fish factory on the water. And so a lot of sophisticated equipment that can go bust, what do you do about it? One of the first risk management steps you can take is just regular maintenance. And that is actually a very powerful tool in all of this. And so in your business plan, you talk about how you regularly maintain your vessel. Okay, let's just take a step back again. One of the purposes of a business plan is if you need money. And I've heard from a few people in this ever-growing, troubling climate that we're in with the recession that money is going to be tougher to get from lenders. And so people actually in the fishing business may need to start doing business plans. So let's just, as we go through these examples, let's act like we're a lender. Let's act like we're a bank and that we want a business plan. So we'll use these examples and sort of reference back to that on occasion to see how it would flow in a business plan. But one of the first things, you know, say as a lender, you want to make sure this little fish factory is going to keep running. And how are you going to assure me that it's going to keep running? Well, I regularly maintain my vessel. I set aside $4,000 or $5,000, whatever the amount is, for the spring for work on my boat every year. It is in top shape. Insurance is obviously a risk management tool for this if you have equipment failure. And so you want to hull and machinery insurance may assist you in certain cases if you have the right kind of coverage. And so that's something that's another tool for the toolbox. And then I think one of the important ones here is your own education, your crew's education and how to fix these problems when they come up. And that's, you know, again, that's a mitigation step. You're taking some steps in the event of a equipment failure, you know how to fix it. And there's good resources out there. You know, my outfit, the Marine Advisory Program, it right now is doing marine refrigeration classes in a number of towns. They're actually bringing in the refrigeration companies who are making this, and they're putting on classes about how to fix these things. Another big resource, an obvious resource, is AVTEC in Seward, the Alaska Vocational Technical Center. Engine repair and that kind of thing. And a lot of schools do it. UAS has engine repair classes. And you know, I just would encourage you, if you've got some downtime and you're interested in learning a little bit more about your equipment and to the extent that you can't fix an engine, I could use it, obviously. That's a good resource. And that's a big risk management tool. And it certainly looks good in your management plan and your business plan. Okay, next slide, please. All right. Safety is a huge issue in fishing, and I think it's such an issue that it probably could be its own category because, you know, it's not exactly a production risk. But not having a lot of guidance on this, I decided that we might as well put it there. It could stand on its own, obviously. Safety and having strong risk management tools is critical for your crew and yourself and your vessel, and it's just really important. I think that if I was to design a risk management plan for my fishing operation, my number one tool would be safety training, and I would look towards a group like AMSI, the Alaska Marine Safety Education Association. And it's a group out of Sitka, and they're the group that does all the safety classes. And if you go online right now, I have the link on our online site. You can see right now the slate of safety instruction classes that they have this spring. What they do a lot of times is they'll give instructions for drill instructors, and then those instructors will be in the various communities and they'll offer classes too. And they work quite well with the Coast Guard. And I just think that's obviously the critical thing. And in talking to the folks at AMSI, let's say one of the most important things that anyone can do in a fishing operation, and it may seem a little bit ho-hum at the time, but it's do the drills. There's drills that you want to do in case of an emergency. They said that a crew that has gone through the drills on a regular basis, you know, even when it's sunny and shiny out, stand a much better chance of surviving in that 2 or 3 minutes that you have to actually get together all the safety equipment, to throw out the beacon equipment and all that kind of stuff that you need to get rescued. So do the drills. Learn them and do them. Vessel and hull insurance is a good risk management tool. You really need to have it. Especially if you have a loan, you have to have it, right? So, but that will protect you in case of a sinking. Safety gear, clearly. You want to have the best that you can and the latest that you can, and go beyond minimums. Coast Guard has minimum requirements for various vessels, and if you can go beyond that, that's just great. And the obvious thing that you could do as part of your risk management plan is just to avoid that horrible weather. So if you don't have to go out and you can withstand losing a couple extra bucks, it's probably the right bet when the weather's really tough. So this is, for such an important subject, a very quick overview. I think your risk management plan for safety can be quite extensive. Okay, next one, if we could. Now here's a production risk that's pretty obvious. No fish or very, very little fish. And what do you do when they don't come in? Here in Southeast, the last couple summers, at least in the northern end, we didn't see a lot of coho. Pinks was a problem here. What do you do? So it's either, it could be low stocks, or maybe the fish are running a little bit late and you didn't anticipate it and you just missed out on the rush. So now if you have a sense that there's not going to be enough fish to break even, you could simply not fish. That's an avoidance tactic, but a good one. If you've figured out your cost structure for your fishery and you know that if you can't exceed a certain volume that you're not even going to break even, then you need to think long and hard about putting the boat in the water. It may not be the right thing to do. of course, there's reasons why you may need to, so leave that to you, but it's important to know your cost structure in the event that they're forecasting very low runs. Diversification is probably the biggest help tool for poor production in one fishery. You know, a couple years ago, back in 2001, 2002, when we had a huge glut of pink salmon on the market, coupled with some ever dwindling trends towards the current consumption base of canned pink salmon in the U.S. When those two things converged, you had a ton of pink salmon going into the warehouses, and that created a real disincentive to buy. The price went down to 9 cents a pound. For those harvesters that had nothing but a seine permit, and say were fishing in Southeast, that was really tough. I mean, if you didn't have a little bit of halibut, maybe some sailfish, some crab, some other means of revenue, and some other fishery to turn to, if you're solely dependent on one particular fish, then it gets tough, and it helps to diversify. Direct marketing is one way that you might be able to deal with low runs. The hallmark of direct marketers is high quality, and you see a lot of them. In fact, I don't think I've met a direct marketer who markets their entire catch. Almost all of them are going to put the majority of their volume to their processor and maintain that relationship. And a lot of times they'll take the shoulder season catch, spend a lot of time with it because it's low runs and it's a slow fishery, and they can spend a lot of time baiting that fish. That's something that you may want to consider. Again, it's just a tool in the toolbox for a time when the stocks may be down a little bit. You're obviously going to have slow fisheries. Maybe take some time, move into the direct market. It wouldn't be all your fish, but some of it, and you might actually find that you make a little bit more from that. Of course, if you get in direct marketing, you've got a whole new suite of risks, and we could focus on that, but for now we'll move on to other things. All right. Taking a look at some kinds of market risks, the one example we had is if you don't have a buyer, or you have just a couple buyers that are out there, what are the things that you can do in your business and set in place? A lot of the suggestions that I have for market risks, I wouldn't call no-brainers, but they really aren't hard and fast. It's about relationship building. Some of them are really hard, I think, to achieve, and so I put them out here knowing that they might be difficult to get to. And at any rate, again, I think this, in terms of risks that you face outside of that safety risk, I think market risks are the ones that you really have to retain. You can't do a whole lot about. But let's take a look at some ideas. Again, you can go back to direct marketing. If there are too few buyers, then maybe one of your only options is to move some of your product for yourself. Okay, and direct marketing is a way to do that. Now, a lot of people talk about forming cooperatives when there's a vacuum of buyers. Cooperatives, as we've talked about before, we had an entire class, I think February 10th, we looked at starting a seafood cooperative. So if you're interested in that and haven't seen that class, Andrew Crow and Hans Geyer did a great job talking about that, so go watch that. Cooperatives are simply, in this reference, a producer organization. So the fishermen are the producers. The cooperative is there to take your product, process it, and market it. Okay, that's easy to say, not so easy to do, but it is nonetheless an effective way at, if it gets up and running, it's an effective way at moving large volumes of fish for individuals. I think one of the reasons that a cooperative can be successful if it's up and running is because it's a way for the harvester to have a financial interest in the success of the processor. Okay, because you're one and the same. And that, I think, is a very powerful influencer in terms of overall attitude and behavior on the water. Rather than having angst between harvester and processor, you are actually working together. You understand their market concerns. When I say you, you're the harvester understands the processor's marketing concerns and works to meet those concerns in your operation. And, of course, you stand to gain once the processor has sold the fish. And in saying that, this is the other way I think you can deal with market risk to the extent you can. It's to try to develop that positive relationship with your buyer. Okay, they are your customer, ultimately. And it's weird to think of it that way, but the processor is buying your product. They are your customer. It's really important to the extent that they let you in and you let yourself in to understand what is their market plan. What are they doing? What do they need? And work to cooperate with them. We do have some examples in the state where it's not a cooperative, but you have certain processors who are saying to their harvesters, look, you guys can, we'll do a straight profit share. I'll open up my books to you at the end of the season. You get half of what I make. But I need you to do a few things. You know, for instance, all RSW boats are all iced fish, whatever it is. I think that those are the kinds of relationships that should work out in the long run for both parties. Certainly hope so. Next slide. Now, there's a lot of competing products out there, and you can compete at the dock or with other protein sources in the world. First thing that you can do, I think, in terms of a risk management plan, and again, this fits into your marketing plan. You know, a lot of times, when I've talked about this in the past, I've suggested that a marketing plan, it really isn't that big of a thing for a harvester, and I still don't think it is, and very involved, certainly compared to being a direct marketer or in any kind of merchandising business. But nonetheless, you still can do a marketing plan. So these are some things to think about. Again, communicate with that first buyer. Have a relationship with that first buyer. Find out what it is they want, because if you're competing with other fish at the dock, you know, it's possible over time you might be able to develop a relationship where they're able to take your product and put it into a program that might get you a slightly higher return. And again, I think it's easier said than done, but I think some processors are willing to take that chance with some people out there. You can look to other markets, and no, this is not that simple. Certainly, if you're in a place like Chignik, it might be hard to get another buyer to come in, and maybe you end up tendering your product over to Kodiak or something like that, but that's another way to try to move all the product at your dock, try to move it off and find another buyer for it. Another thing I think is important to do, and it's more of a kind of a global piece, but I think it's important for everyone fishing in the industry, is to think about the differentiation and the branding work that's going on with your product at the market level, and to the extent you can, become a part of that, fit into that. And now what I'm talking about here is generally work that's done by the Alaska Seafood Marketing Institute, the wild, nutritious, sustainable kinds of themes are at play all the time. And so to the extent that you as a harvester can get your operation in that mode, you know, that helps. Okay, there are a lot of things coming down the way that you can see in terms of market trends that you might adjust your business to and take advantage of that, and also build on what a group like ASME is doing. Not just ASME, but you now have these regional seafood development associations that are popping up. We have one in Bristol Bay, and we have one in Copper River, and there are others that have been organized and looking to develop a tax assessment from the fleet. These groups will be working on, they may be working on marketing differentiation work and branding work that could bring value to your product. So it's important to at the very least, dial into these efforts and see how they work for you. Okay, as a little bit of a departure here, next slide, please. Right. I wanted to take a look at some of the competition that's out there so we can look at. If you want to go ahead and click here, I have this on animation, unfortunately, but it's just two clicks to do it. Now, when we talk about, you know, developing a marketing plan, you need to look, I think, beyond just fish. And so I want to take a look at a little bit of the protein that's out there. I mean, really, when someone goes to the grocery store, they're not looking at wild salmon versus farm salmon. They're looking at all the various kinds of potential meats that are there that they can put on their plate. And you've got, of course, your pork, your beef, and your chicken. Those are the big players out there, like it or not. Now, world trends are showing an increase in protein consumption. And these numbers are just slightly dated, so I could see them increasing. But I think these are FAO numbers. But in 1995, the number that I had here as a reference was 127 pounds of meat per person in 1995, 127. And by 2004, it had grown to 140 pounds. So you're seeing a over 10 pound increase per person consumption of meat in the world. Higher income levels, urbanization, population growth, large increases in developing nations. These are all reasons why you're seeing people eating more meat. In the U.S., we're not going to be outdone here. There's no way. We also have increased our meat consumption by 10 pounds in the past 10 years. But I should go to say that we're eating 200 pounds of meat a year as opposed to 140. Again, we're not going to be outdone. But the trends, you know, there's more value-added products going on. That tends to create more meat consumption. There's a lot more food service. We're going to restaurants more often. These kinds of things are happening in the U.S., and we're simply eating more meat. So I think it's important to understand that you're not just competing against the guy in the boat next to you or even against the dreaded farm salmon or the aquaculture products, but there is a lot of other animals and critters out there. And actually, these trends are very positive. Next slide, please. Okay, hopefully this shows up for you okay. It's pretty standard. If you've been looking at, been to any kinds of presentations on aquaculture growth in the world, this is an obvious trend for you. The blue is capture fisheries. The yellow is aquaculture. The time is from 1995 to 2005. You'll see that aquaculture is growing at about a 7% clip every year. Capture fisheries are remaining much the same. Now, a portion of the capture fisheries here is for industrial purposes, fish oil and fish meal. It is not for human consumption. So, you know, if I was to differentiate that in the blue line, we may see that aquaculture, which is mainly for human consumption, aquaculture is rivaling the capture fisheries for human consumption. So that is obviously the big player on the block. They will continue to grow. I don't see them stopping. They might grow slower than 7% annually, but I think they will continue to grow. They will continue to find efficiencies in their production and continue to find market acceptance. So and their price relatively will fall. So you need to be prepared for this in your business. Okay, how are you going to do this? I guess I'm not giving you the answer. I'm just suggesting that you need to pay attention to it. If we go to the next slide, please. Finally, and again, these numbers are teeny, but I bolded them up, and you can get this off the National Marine Fisheries Service. They always have these numbers every year. These are seafood numbers, and we've got 2000 through 2006 here. And off to the side, off to the right, we've got our friends again. We've got Mr. Pig, Mr. Cow, and Mr. Chicken. And in the banners, you see the average per person consumption in the U.S. of these products, and numbers change a little bit, but essentially pork's at about 50 pounds per person. Beef is at about, this one says 64 pounds, but I've seen 70, and chicken is here at 74 pounds, but around 70. One thing to note on chicken is that since World War II, since the Depression, chicken has grown from about 20 pounds a person up to that 70 mark. It has absolutely eclipsed beef, which is very interesting given that it is such a smaller animal and a little harder, I think, to process and knock down. What you've seen happen in the chicken industry is the reason, one of the reasons for its tremendous growth is the way that its sector has grown in terms of vertical integration and combining the raising, ranching with the harvesting, excuse me, with the processing of the chicken. It's been very industrialized. So something kind of like what you see, I think, in the aquaculture industry. Now, one of the things that I think is important, that I think is important from this particular slide here, is that you have on the side, on the right-hand side, you've got these three categories of products, and we all know that there's differences in the cuts of meat between the pork, beef, and chicken. But consumers are pretty familiar with this, and makes a lot of sense. Now the total seafood consumption per person, according to these numbers, by the time we get to 2006, is about 16.5 pounds. Okay, that's about a fourth of what you find with any of these other major products. So 16 pounds. And look at the diversity of products within that big number. Okay, shrimp is number one. You've got tuna, salmon, pollock, tilapia. I mean, these are very different critters, and they all have their ways of being prepared, you know, that needs to be dealt with and done. They come from different parts of the world. They're coming in from different suppliers. It's a very diverse, very, very, I think, difficult to deal with industry if you're a retailer or food service. Alternatively, it's a very rich, very exciting food line. And so you're part of that. And I think that can factor in some way into your marketing plan. You at least need to be aware. I think you need to at least be aware of some of the difficulties associated with moving seafood products for some of the larger processors. And to the extent you can, in developing a positive relationship with them, demonstrate some understanding of the world they live in. It is a complex one. And again, it has potential big upsides. And again, takeaway points is protein consumption is increasing in the world. Seafood consumption is increasing. And here in Alaska, we are sitting on the best seafood products that are out there. And so I think that's very encouraging. And that, I think, is part of everyone's business plan here. Okay, enough of that. Next slide, if you would, please. Thank you. Last kind of market risk that we have here is consumer trends. And again, these aren't things you can do a whole lot about, but I think they're important to deal with and look at. You can have consumer trends that are trending away from consumption of your product, then that's a problem. And you know, things like, I think one of the trends we saw with farmed salmon is a pretty interesting one. All of a sudden, there's this huge glut of this salmon product on the market. People are having access to salmon they didn't have before. And so it really took a hit on the Alaska salmon harvester. However, in about 5 years or so, at least that's what it felt like, consumers are becoming more intelligent, more aware, recognizing the difference, and wanting the wild salmon, and creating a strong difference in price. Okay, we're slightly able to break that price barrier that we were under and getting sucked under by farmed salmon. So there's a couple different ways that consumer trends can be good and bad, but it's important to know those and have those as part of your market assessment. Okay, I keep looking up at the clock. That's what's over. Now, this next category is legal risks. If we could get you to click that, thank you. First one, and it's the big one, and it's I write damages here, but basically it's liabilities that accrue to you that could befall you from accidents at sea, and it's a big category. It's a very scary category, and so there's a lot of risk management tools that people can implement and take to deal with that. Now, I'll run through what I've got here in terms of things that you can do about it, but we're going to take some time out here, and after I'm done, and go to a discussion that we had last fall. In October, we had a class where a gentleman named Mark Manning came in. Mark is a maritime attorney out of Anchorage. He's been at it for a long time, and he was able to come and join us for about 20, 30 minutes and talk about some of his observations, some of the issues you face dealing with maritime law and liabilities. And unfortunately, we didn't have a whole day with Mark, which I know he could have filled. But I think it's important to go back to that and take a listen to it here here in just a moment. Some of the things you can do to deal with liability that accrue at sea. One of the first things you think about is what kind of organizational structure, corporate structure should I have? If you're familiar with this, then you'll know that in a proprietorship, that's a single owner operator, which is a default organizational structure. If something happens in your business where you're sued for millions and millions of dollars, to the extent your business can't make up that suit, then it digs into your personal assets. And the same thing happens with a partnership. They don't protect you from liability. And so that's why we have the corporate form. And what we've found through talking to people like Mark Manning is that a good corporate structure does not necessarily protect you from accidents at sea, given the way maritime law is treated. And so corporate structure is important. It's something to think about, but it's not a protect-all against these kinds of risks. Obviously, the most important one, I think, if not the one of the most important ones, is protection and indemnity insurance, P&I insurance. You need to have a healthy dose of it. And in case you have accidents, that can help you out. I think training is another way to alleviate some of the potential liability that could occur at sea. We talk about collisions at sea or accidents that occur. If you have proper training or your crew has proper training, it should at least at some points eliminate some of those accidents. Can't eliminate all of them, but it might cut down on a few. Again, that's a mitigating step that's pretty important. Vessel and equipment maintenance is helpful to make sure your boat's running well and proceeding as it normally would. It may reduce the chances of sinkings, collisions, especially if your navigation equipment is in good order and you've got that well established. That should help eliminate some of those problems. And employee, we'll talk more about this in a bit, but employee contracts can be important too. Particularly when we talk about liabilities, if we're talking about crew lawsuits against you for injury that occur, you know, you could find some protection if you've got a good crew contract that identifies pre-existing injuries. And it may be some protection in the scope of things. Okay, with that, I think Gloria or Hugh is going to be able to cue us on to Mark Manning's talk. I'll be quiet for a minute and come back and finish up the rest of the class here. So.
This one. One of the things you might want to turn to if you're thinking about cooperatives is a publication, and I attached a link on our class website, but this is a publication put out by Sea Grant, Developing Cooperatives for the Alaska Seafood Industry. It may be useful for you. It runs you through a lot of the different ups and downs to doing this and gives you some ideas whether you want to get started on something like that. So that's a quick talk about organizational structures, and that's what I've got. I don't know if anyone has any questions out there. Call in or email us. But at this point, if I could just see if we can fly somehow to Anchorage and see if Mark is there for us. Mark?
Yes. Are you able to hear me? I want to make sure I'm handling this microphone correctly.
Yep, just great. Mark, can you hear me here?
Yes.
Okay, super. Please, go ahead.
All right. I was last on television in 1959 in an educational program, and my TV career tanked at that point, and it's good to be back. What I'm going to be addressing is how to avoid or limit liability in the event of injury or damage caused by you or your operation to another person or other property. I will be skimming the surface. There's apparently limited opportunity to ask questions during the presentation. So if there are any questions about details, don't hesitate to email me at Manning, M-A-N-N-I-N-G, at alaska.net. My legal malpractice insurer would probably be angry with me if I did not also say that nothing I say here today should be taken to be legal advice to you in particular, and if you want to pursue any of the thoughts that I identify today, then by all means meet with a lawyer and discuss that with him or her. The legal outcomes and legal arrangements that may be appropriate are usually a function of the particular circumstances of the particular person or company, and for the most part, it is not a one-size-fits-all proposition. There's a lot of tailoring that has to be done. I'll be addressing liability, that is, becoming obligated under the law to compensate another person, another business, the government, for example, because of some event that has occurred, either an event that you have caused or someone for whom you're responsible has caused, that ultimately requires you to fork over a good deal of money to that person or that entity. Examples are personal injury, which occur very frequently in the fishing industry, vessel or other damage caused by collision, elision, pollution, and so on. And we're dealing here with the subject of risk management. Of course, whenever one gets out of bed in the morning, one faces an array of risks, and hopefully the probabilities that any of those risks may come home are all small, but they vary, and some probabilities as to particular risk may be greater than others. And the idea is to try to go about one's business managing the atmosphere of risks in such a way that at the end of the day when you go back to bed, nothing bad has happened, or if something bad has happened, you have made arrangements to limit the consequences of that bad thing. Wearing a seatbelt would be a great example when you go about your business driving. So we're not talking about the fun part here, catching fish and selling them and reaping the benefits. We're talking about protecting the equipment that you have accumulated with which you do that and protecting your future from the risk of having to, over time, pay someone else a great deal of money because you or your operation has accidentally injured that person or business. I'm going to start with the basic question that lawyers get often, and that is, can I arrange my business in such a way, typically incorporate or form a limited liability company, that will protect me from liability? And the answer is definitely not entirely, but yes, to an extent. In a way, again, it's sort of like putting on a seatbelt. That will not protect the driver from every conceivable accident that may befall his vehicle, but it certainly will greatly reduce the number of types of accident that could occur that will result in injury to that driver. And so incorporating or forming a limited liability company will kind of reduce the size of the bullseye on your back, but it will not remove that bullseye entirely. Most particularly, if you happen to be the actor who causes the harm that gives rise to a liability, it doesn't matter whether you are a sole proprietor, that is not incorporated, or a shareholder in the fishing corporation or a member of the fishing LLC, your liability will be the same for your own actions, regardless of your situation. And the reason, or an example of the limited benefit sometimes of incorporating occurs where the would-be incorporator is the owner of the vessel and also the operator of the vessel, and will always be the person in charge of the fishing operation, and always or most of the time will be operating the vessel, directing the crew, hiring the crew, training the crew, and so on. If a liability arises from some error in any of those acts, the fact of being incorporated will provide virtually no protection from liability to that person. But there are other scenarios in which liability can arise where corporations or limited liability companies will provide a shield or at least a partial shield, and we'll get to that. I wanted to review at least the common liabilities that arise, partly by way of saying this is not theory. This really happens numerous times each year, although with reduced frequency compared to the early 80s when I started practicing admiralty and maritime law up here in Alaska. Admiralty and maritime law, for the most part, does govern liabilities arising out of the ownership or operation of a vessel. And again, for the most part, liability is predicated on negligence. That is, the failure to use reasonable care under all of the circumstances that then gives creates some injury or damage to a person or property. Liability is said to lie in negligence at that point, and compensation normally has to be paid to the injured party or injured entity. Examples, of course, are crew injury, injury to other vessels that may occur due to collision, although it seems to happen less frequently now. In the 80s and perhaps some of the 90s, it seemed as though almost every year a dragger would run into the side of a freighter going through Unimak Pass because the crew member running the dragger fell asleep or stepped off the bridge to go to the head or something. And of course, that could give rise to liability not only to the freighter, which usually sailed on as though nothing much had happened, but it would also give rise to other crew members in the dragger who might have been tossed out of their bunks or otherwise suffered some personal injury. The employer of that helmsman would be liable to other crew members who were injured by reason of the helmsman falling asleep or otherwise not being adequately attentive to the helm. Alaska law, which also is based primarily on negligence, liability is based primarily on negligence, governs operations that occur ashore. For example, moving things around on a dock, if a third party were injured, a pedestrian walking on the dock were injured by those operations, probably Alaska law would govern that. If crew members drive to the grocery store to buy groceries for the vessel and happen to strike a pedestrian, Alaska law would probably govern that, and so on. In the realm of crew injury, while negligence governs liability to a large extent, there are other potential grounds of liability. One is called unseaworthiness, which refers to some aspect of the vessel that renders the vessel not reasonably safe for its intended service. And that problem might arise due to no fault whatsoever on the part of the owner or operator. But in ordinary operations, for example, if fish debris winds up on a established walkway, that may render the walkway slippery and unfit for use as a walkway, no matter how ordinary and foreseeable it is that the debris wind up there. Dock damage is fairly infrequent, but that would be another potential type of liability. And then sinking, of course, can give rise to liability to the government for pollution damage. Liability may also arise in favor of fishermen if the pollution contaminates a particular fishery. Likewise, if the sinking occurs in port, very commonly a float will be broken or twisted or something, and by the weight of the vessel hanging there, and liability can arise against the are in favor of the city whose boat harbor is damaged. So, Glenn spoke previously about corporations and limited liability companies. The corporation form has been around a lot longer than the limited liability company. The corporation form, when one has only one or two or three shareholders, is pretty simple. But there are some technicalities that have to be observed in the way of at least annual meetings and taking major decisions by means of a resolution, ideally voted on by members of the board of directors. And the relatively newer entity called the limited liability company that has become popular in the last 15 years or so, I think has become the default choice simply because there are fewer technicalities that need to be honored in order to be confident that the law will treat this entity as a legal entity separate from its owners, which must occur in order for the entity to provide the shield to liability that's usually desired. There are some considerations that may require the corporate form to be chosen over the limited liability company form, but I would say that for virtually all Alaskan fishing vessels, fishing companies who want to form a separate entity as a means of managing liability, the limited liability company is, I think, the default choice. How does one form a limited liability company or a corporation? The Alaska Division of Corporations has now and for some time had a website on which one can fill in the blanks on a form and I think pay by credit card, or I believe there is an option to send a check in. And practically on the spot, one can form a corporation or a limited liability company. I would caution against that because in order to be reasonably confident of being able to rely on the shield of a corporation or a limited liability company, other things need to be done in order to preserve its existence as a separate entity. And one needs to go to school a little bit with a lawyer to make sure those things are done. Conceivably, one could form a corporation or a limited liability company on the internet and then schedule an hour with a lawyer to say, okay, I've created this entity. Now what do I have to do in order to preserve it and take care of it and take full advantage of it in the future? I'm thinking especially of the ads I hear on the radio of a Nevada inviting people to form a Nevada corporation, and I've actually seen a few of those in cases, and if a layman simply does that and nothing more, there will be a serious risk that corporation will not be a shield when the time a shield is needed arrives. So how does this realistically affect liability? The key concept here is called vicarious liability. For sea lawyers out there, the Latin is respondeat superior, that is, the master has to respond for damage done by the servant. As I said earlier on, if you, as a sole proprietor or the sole shareholder in a corporation or the sole member or one of several members in a limited liability company, if you are the author of an act of negligence that causes injury to another person, you will be personally liable and your personal assets on the line as a result. And there's nothing you can do in the way of forming an entity that will excuse you of that liability. However, if an employee, a crew member, or someone who might ordinarily be a partner is the author of that act, and you are not incorporated, you're a sole proprietor who is the employer of that person, or you have formed a classic partnership, which is another very old form of business organization or arrangement. If you're a partnership and an employee of the partnership or another partner in the partnership is the author of that act, then all of the partners are personally liable for the consequences. However, if the actor is an employee of a corporation or a limited liability company, then the assets of the owners, the shareholders, the members of the entity will not, at least initially, be on the hook. The assets of the entity alone normally will have to respond to make good on that employee's negligent act. And I'll just by way of background, the owners of a corporation, of course, are referred to as shareholders, and the owners of a limited liability company are referred to as members of the company. The reason I suggested that to incorporate or to form a limited liability company will not be a total shield is that if a shareholder or a member is an active participant in the venture, then there is a serious likelihood that he will have some avenue of personal exposure. The example I gave is if the owner is the one whose hands are on the helm because he's operating the vessel, and the vessel then runs into another vessel at anchor, he's going to be responsible for that. But let's say that the owner, the member, the shareholder, is not in the wheelhouse, and that a crew member is operating the helm and does so negligently, falls asleep or steps away from the helm and runs into another vessel. Well, in the first instance, that employee would be liable to that damaged vessel and perhaps the people on board who were injured. And that employee, that crew member's employer, the fishing company, will also be on the hook. Its assets will be on the hook. And in the first instance, the first line of defense, the owners of the corporation, the members of the limited liability company, will not be personally exposed. But suppose one of the members of the LLC was, in fact, operating the vessel and in charge of the vessel, and he hired that crew member, and the crew member really wasn't competent to carry out the duties he was assigned to do. That may give rise to a claim of negligent hiring against the member of the LLC, and suddenly the shield of the LLC is penetrated, because even though the member of the LLC was not an actor in the wheelhouse who caused the negligence, in a kind of secondary sense, he contributed to the cause of the accident because he negligently hired this person whose hands were on the helm. Likewise, there can be a claim for negligent training. There may be a claim against an owner because he didn't hire enough crew members. There could be a claim against the owner because the owner assigned only a single crew member to a heavy job that was a, quote, two-man job, end quote, and as a result, the crew member hurt himself straining to do the job alone. So even though the owner of an entity, a corporation, LLC, that has been created to provide a shield to liability, even though the owner was not the actor that gave rise to the injury or the damage, there may have been some error or omission on the part of the owner in the background that set the stage for that that action that would still expose the owner to personal liability. So that's why I say the formation of a corporation or a limited liability company is just not fail-safe by any stretch. It's a good defense for vicarious liability or the automatic liability of the employer for errors or omissions of the employee, but there may still have been personal involvement in setting the stage for the accident on the part of the owner that would result in a hook into him and his assets regardless. There's in that respect, there's just no substitute for adequate insurance. In addition to forming a corporation or a limited liability company, if one wanted to take the belt and suspenders approach to managing risk, one could go so far as to convey personal assets to a spouse or form a family trust and so on. But those secondary strategies, which I don't see done very often, are beyond the scope of today's discussion. So we do have limited protection in the form of the so-called corporate veil or a shield. How can this protection be destroyed? If the shareholders of a corporation or the members of an LLC do not treat it and respect it as a separate legal entity at arm's length from them, and their own personal business, then the court system is probably not going to respect it as a separate legal entity either. And so one has to go about conducting the business of the corporation or the LLC in such a way to establish it as and maintain it as a separate legal entity. Perhaps the most common error in this regard is that a fisherman or a fisherman and his wife forms a corporation and really doesn't treat it as a separate legal entity, and in particular do not distinguish between corporate revenue and personal revenue, so that all of the corporate revenue goes into their personal account, corporate operating expenses are paid with personal checks out of their personal account, personal funds, truly personal funds, go in and out of the same account. That's referred to as commingling of funds, and obviously they're not treating the corporation and its business as different financially from their own, and that's a serious mistake. It's imperative that when one of these entities is created, that one or more checking and other accounts, if needed, be established for it, and that personal funds do not flow in and out of that account, and that account is not tapped casually for personal expenses. In general, corporate funds should not flow to the shareholders in any way other than the few classic ways, that is, the shareholder may be an employee and it may be appropriate to pay a salary and or bonus to that employee, and that's okay. That's a permissible way for corporate funds to flow to the owner, and likewise the corporation may pay dividends. Probably not a good idea tax-wise, but it may pay dividends to the shareholders, and that's a permissible way for corporate funds to flow. But to just willy-nilly have members or shareholders dip into corporate funds, again, could be thought of as an act of disrespect to the corporate entity, which could be destructive down the road so far as the shield effect. The courts also expect that a corporation or a limited liability company will insure itself sufficiently and will be capitalized by its shareholders or members with enough money to conduct its operations in a way that in a solvent fashion. For example, if you need $10,000 or $20,000 in ready operating cash in order to operate a company, and the shareholders lend that amount of money to the corporation, and the money doesn't become the corporation's, then that's going to look like the shareholders really didn't quite finish setting up a corporation, investing it with all of the money and other property that it needs as a business to operate. Whereas if the shareholders give money to the corporation in exchange for shares, that's a normal act. And so long as the corporation is in that way given enough money to conduct business, then the courts are going to feel that it has, in fact, truly been set up as a standalone business. Likewise, the courts expect that corporations will have adequate amounts of liability insurance to address liabilities that might normally be expected in the conduct of that type of business. And if one were to set up a corporation specifically, say, to avoid having to pay $15,000 or $25,000 worth of P&I premium every year, at thinking that one could safely hide behind an uninsured corporation, a court might well decide to pierce the corporate veil, set that corporate shield aside, because the corporation was not adequately vested with the means to address liabilities that could foreseeably arise. And the normal means of vesting a company with that kind of protection is to buy adequate insurance. And at least with
respect... Can you... I've been given the two-minute warning, unfortunately. We could probably go on for a long time. Is maybe summing up or closing pieces here? In our,
sure.
Unfortunately, our short time, I'm sorry.
I wanted to mention a couple of several other ways to manage risk, since the corporation or LLC will not completely do that. One is a bare-boat charter. I won't go into the elements of a bare-boat charter for lack of time, but I have seen instances in which a family member has allowed another family member or friend to borrow a vessel on a handshake. And if an accident then occurs, a claim may come back against the owner of that vessel that could have been deflected if a written bare-boat charter to the user of the vessel had been created. Second, P&I insurance, get it. I've run into a number of instances where the owner felt that since his crew is family members and longtime family friends, it wasn't necessary. That too frequently will catch up with people, if for no other reason than it's very easy to run up a medical bill of $100,000 or $200,000 before you even get out of intensive care. There's going to be a lot of pressure to try to find a source of that money. Post-casualty actions. Any significant accident is going to require a report to the Coast Guard, filling out Block 44 in the 2692. How did the casualty occur? Consult with a lawyer before you write down how the casualty occurred. 2692B, the form, requires drug and alcohol tests right after an accident. Take care to attend to that, because a failure to do that can be used as an evidence point against the vessel operator at a later time. And finally, limitation of liability. Under some circumstances, a vessel owner can file an action in federal court to limit his or its liability to the value of the vessel, typically when the owner has not been directly involved in the cause of the incident, but might be vicariously liable for it. An action can be filed in federal court. It has to be filed promptly. Another good reason to talk to a lawyer to make sure that you don't miss the deadline on filing that action. I'll conclude my remarks there. Again, I invite you to email me at manning@alaska.net, if you have any follow-up questions.
Thank you, Mark. I want to thank you. We could probably go for quite some time on this discussion, and I hate to cheat it as we did there, but thank you for your remarks. That's very helpful, and I've got a couple of questions, but we just unfortunately don't have time to continue on. So thank you, Mark, for joining us, and thank you all. We'll be back again next week, same time.
We'll be
talking about evaluating investment opportunities.
So we're back on. Okay, that wasn't the end of the class, in case you just had logged in. Well, I want to thank again, Mark, for doing that. That was, again, back in October of 2008, and you can find that discussion and a number of other classes back on the class site that's still up for that, and you can get that through the Marine Advisory Program website and through my profile page. Okay, so we're back talking about various other legal risks. Again, thanks to Mark for that. That was great. I do wish we would have had an entire day to do that with him. That was unfortunate. We had to cut off like that. Okay, another legal risk that you might run, and I call it a legal risk because it could lead to legal actions, is not getting paid. And, you know, most of the processors operating in Alaska are pretty solvent, but there is, you always hear once a year or twice a year or something like that of a processor coming in and not being able to make payment to the fishermen. So, again, there's not a lot of things that I hear people can do about that, but here's some ideas. Some worse than others, but none of them really that secure. One is the idea of a contract, although I don't think I've ever heard of a processor and a harvester having a contract. I'm not sure either would want it. But you know, fishermen can't even get a price sometimes of what they're going to get paid for their fish. But if there was a world where one could get a contract, that seems like that would be a good risk management tool. Absent that, if you're working with a new processor and you want to do some due diligence on them to find out if they're very strong, I think you can check with various agencies that are neutral bodies and just ask them quietly for advice. One agency that deals a lot with seafood processors, not on the business side of things, but in the health and food safety, is the Department of Environmental Conservation. You can check with them to see if a new processor in your area has been up and running elsewhere. That's a good check. Local Chamber of Commerce may have some insight, and certainly your local, regional, or state economic development agencies may know about processors that are just moving into your area if you want to make sure that they're solid risks. And then there's one other tool that you could go to, although I don't think it's very strong, and that is the Department of Revenue does require a bond from all seafood processors. The bond is to do a number of things, including pay employees if they don't get paid by the processor, but it is also to be used for fishermen who don't get paid. Of course, if someone's going to go bust, they probably are going to owe hundreds of thousands of dollars, and the bond probably won't cover. But at least it's something that maybe an individual can pursue if they have an individual complaint with a processor. Okay, and the last legal risk that I'm just going to point out here, and again, none of this is comprehensive. There are all kinds of risks, but we're just using some examples here. And that's a good old-fashioned tax audit. Now, there's nothing you can do to stop from getting a tax audit. But if you do get audited, you want to make sure that you'll come out of it smelling like a rose. Now, there's a lot of things you can do about that. The first thing is to do a good job with your in-season record keeping. Okay, keep all your receipts, identify them appropriately, make sure you're able to clarify what your expenses are for. Write on the receipt what certain things were if it's not listed out, and just be very specific about that and do a good job keeping records. That'll also obviously help you take a lot of deductions off as well, so that should save you some money in the process. Lots of good reasons for good in-season record keeping. Obviously, getting an experienced tax accountant is helpful, one that knows the rules and may not push it too far. Now, remember that with tax accountants, that some of them have different levels of tolerance for risk as well, and some will be more riskier than others. And so I would just encourage you to be careful and to ask carefully. I have had a chance to do some classes on filing income taxes, and had an IRS auditor come and talk with us and work with us. And a lot of the things that I'd heard out and about that fishermen have been writing off for a number of years simply are not acceptable and would lead to fines and penalties if they were caught. So I would caution you to be careful of that. Probably the best thing to do is to take a look at, and I do believe I included it as a link here on our OnClass site, is take a look at this IRS field guide for auditors for commercial fishing operations. Basically, it's a pretty involved document that tells the IRS auditor what he or she needs to look for when they go and audit a fishing business. So it tells them how to look at the fish tickets to make sure that comports with revenues. It tells them all the rules about tax home and all of those kinds of things. And if you read that, you'll get a better sense of what will get you in trouble if in an audit, and especially make sure your accountant has had a chance to look at that. Very important document to look at. Okay, shifting into next slide, please. Oh, I didn't have you click through to the one. Two slides further, please. Thank you. Moving into the category of financial risks, the first one is fishing in a low-value fishery, and you know that can be caused by a downturn in the market or the volumes are down. Of course, we talked a little bit about this when we talked about production risks, but I can talk about it in terms of financial risks because this is something that you can do actually pre-season to get a handle on whether or not it's a good idea to pursue a fishery when you have good insight that it's going to be a low-value one. Again, diversification is important. Don't put all your eggs in one basket. And the other thing is to know your cost structure. Know your variable costs as opposed to your fixed costs. It's good to know that if, say, the price of fuel increases to a certain threshold, that you are going to have to, that you're going to have to catch X amount more of fish in order to be able to break even on your fixed costs. I mean, there's a lot of things that go into this, but there's some good tools out there that can help you figure out what your cost structure is. We've used a number of times in this class the Fisherman's Financial Pro Forma software. You'll find it, I believe, on the class we did, the second class we did. I believe it's January 28th. Might have been January 27th. But in there, we show you this Excel spreadsheet that allows you to input all your cost variables for seven different fisheries, up to seven different fisheries, as well as your revenue projections, and find out what each fishery's profits would be. Now, there's absolutely no reason why you can't use this going into each season and line up all your fisheries that you have, figure out what you think the costs are going to be based on what you're hearing about price, and find out not only if it's a good idea to pursue a fishery, but just how much you think you're going to have to catch in order to break even. Okay, so it's important to think about and try to implement in your preseason work. Okay, another financial risk might be no working capital, okay? And so you're having trouble paying those day-to-day expenses, and what about tax time, okay? Come March, that's a full, sometimes 7 or 8 months after you've been fishing. You got to make sure you've got a chunk of change that you can use to pay the IRS at that point. So having working capital is very important. A couple things that you can do in terms of the risk management tools you can implement. One is to have a business plan. A business plan is going to lay out your various needs over the year to help keep yourself in check. Budgeting accordingly is important. One of the best tools for that, and we've talked about it when we talked about financial statements, is to run cash flow statements. Okay, it's not difficult, and you can have your accountant do it. And a cash flow statement is going to show you your true cash position generally on a month-to-month basis. So you can look at from January to December for the past, say, 5 years, here was when I was cash weak. And so it tells you when you need to save money into the future. It's not hard to do. Cash flow statements are very important. And, as opposed to income statements, which you have on your tax returns generally is an income statement, a cash flow statement is not only going to include your operating expenses and your operating activities, but it's also going to include cash that came in and out of the business from financing and investment activities. And when you have that kind of information, then you get a complete cash picture. So it's important to have these things available and run for purposes of planning. be conservative as you move into a new fishing venture, or you're approaching a season. Stay within your means, and this can be part of your business philosophy. It can be right in a mission statement. It can be one of your goals, even, to stay within your means, and that could be a very important message to send to a lender. Try to get a if you don't already, try to get a line of credit as opposed to using credit cards. I mean, the credit card is going to hit you with 20 to 25%. Now, you might have a credit card from your bank that is essentially a line of credit that works at about 10%. That's great. But you should be able to get that if you've got a pretty solid business plan and you've been in operation for a while. But paying 24% for those early season costs before you get paid, that seems a little bit prohibitive. And a line of credit from a bank should be easy enough to get if you've got a good banking relationship. Next slide, please. So, and then the next one's about not being able to get a loan, which is about building that positive relationship. Okay, one of the things I think you can do about this, and it is really about building a relationship with a banker. Okay, it's about building trust. Now, remember, a banker is going to come from a thought process not unlike my own, where I'm familiar with looking at financial statements. I kind of like it. It shows me the health of a company. You can get a lot out of these numbers if you look at trends from year to year. It's sort of nose in the book kind of world perspective, which you know, it's hard to break out of, but that's sometimes the mode your lender may be in. So you really do have to address that particular area. So creating strong financial statements, historical financial statements to show not only your income statements, okay, but also your balance sheets and your cash flows could be pretty darn important to your banker. At least it shows that you're making an effort to get into that side of their world. Again, we covered financial statements early on in this semester, and we did as well in last semester too. So that's important. Putting together your business plan is going to be very impressive for a lender. I've talked to a number of lenders who have seen the fisheries business pro forma software. They like that a lot. They said if an individual came to them with this filled out that's going to project out potential revenues based on their variable and fixed cost structure, that would be very impressive for a lender. So think about putting all of these things into a sensible business plan when you go to get money. And finally, it's building that relationship. Okay, so, you know, and I've talked to a number of people who live in coastal communities. They say that sometimes their lender really doesn't understand their fishing business, and which is a darn shame, because that is the main economic engine in most of these rural communities. So so you really do have to build that relationship and explain your business and spend some time. If at first it doesn't work, don't give up. Keep working with that lender, and I think eventually they'll see that you're a solid credit risk, and that's going to be important. Okay, last slide here, and then we're out for the day. We're talking about the last of our various risks. It's the human risks, and mainly we're talking about injury to crew here. And Mark Manning touched on a number of these things, but I'd like to cover them again because this really is a critical area. First one is that P&I insurance, and he made the good point. You know, even if you get your friends and family on board, it's still important to have P&I. Not because you expect someone to do something terrible to you, but that you want to protect your crew and make sure that they have enough resources to get well. And remember, if you as the captain of a boat, you are responsible for maintenance and cure of an injured crew member. And that means not only do you have to heal the broken bone, make sure that broken bone heals, but you may have to maintain them until it's healed. So there's a couple levels of cost, and it's not cheap. So it's important to have that P&I. For those that don't know, the Department of Labor administers what's called the Fisherman's Fund, and it's a fund of last resort. It helps pay for medical costs in the case of injury at sea. It's specifically designed for captain and crew, and I think even seafood processing workers can take advantage of it. Not positive of that, but at any rate, it funds at $2,500, but I believe that it's recently been passed by the legislature and the governor's office to allow for $10,000 in payments, which is a little better these days. A crew contract can be quite helpful for you in terms of dealing with crew injury. If a crew member has a pre-existing condition and you know about that in advance, then you can set about job tasks that are going to alleviate stress and fatigue on that particular injury. And if they don't report something, and they claim injury on it at a certain point, and you can find documentation, past history of this kind of injury, it may alleviate certain costs associated with the lawsuit. Of course, no guarantees there, but two real common sense things, well, three, vessel layout, the need for rules and training are really some important mitigating measures that you can take for your crew. Training's important, training in safety and emergency drills and how to use the equipment properly, okay? That stuff is really important, and get the crew members up to speed on how to operate it will be helpful. If you can lay out your vessel to eliminate some of those areas of danger, that's very helpful. If you've got a slippery deck and you can somehow put some abrasive surface on the top of it to avoid spills, that would be useful. And some rules might include how you're going to treat alcohol and drug use on the boat. You know, maybe there's a zero tolerance for that in fishing operations. You see that quite commonly, and you see that captured in crew contracts. And that can eliminate certain injuries. So that's some of the ideas that we have for dealing with risks associated with your crew and injury. You know, if you're having trouble finding crew, you know, one resource you can turn to is the Alaska Department of Labor. They're often queried for that kind of information. So that is one place you can go and have a plan in place for that. But usually you don't hear about that being too much of a problem. At least I haven't for harvesters out there. But and that is what I've got for material today. I don't know that we have anyone who's called in but before I go, I want to thank the folks here in the Ketchikan facility at UAS here. Mike Doyle, I believe, was very helpful in setting this up, and thanks again to everyone in Juneau there for running the helm while we